Okay, the topic is Unitarian ethics. It's kind of a loose topic, and I think that any presentation on Unitarian ethics has to be descriptive rather than prescriptive, since it is against our religion to prescribe any dogma, ethical or theological. So right away we have a problem. This tends to create some confusion as to what is right or wrong in a specific situation, especially if the various religious or secular ethical systems that recommend themselves to us contradict each other in the instant case. One way to avoid confusion is to have some certainty about your core values, that they are your core values, and use these values as a meta-ethic by which you can judge if certain principles or systems are suitable for your use. We have no way to judge if these principles or systems are true or even good in any absolute sense. So relativistic subjectivism is the approach that provides the greatest methodological confidence. Examples of common core values suitable for meta-ethical use might include the golden rule, the categorical imperative, the harmlessness principle, and one of my own inventions that I call the unprofitability principle. And this, which basically takes the folk wisdom that no good turn goes unpunished and uses it as a truth test. A good deed should cost you something. And if you make a profit on it, the goodness may be questionable. Something we need to remember in full self-awareness. Such meta-ethical principles may be used to test our personal ethical systems for consistency, but given the subjective nature of ethics, dissenters will always be heard from, and no universal system is possible. That's basically a short introduction to postmodernism. Therefore, in describing Unitarian ethics, I will take a historical path around this ethical swamp by simply describing some ethical opinions of some famous Unitarians and not injecting any of my own views in any obvious fashion. Of course, I get to choose which Unitarians I will talk about and which of their views I will pay attention to, so any perceptive person may infer my views from how I handle this material. So I'm going to begin with William Ellery Channing, who is pretty much the founder of American Unitarianism. He certainly wasn't the only person involved in creating American Unitarianism, but he was the most outstanding apologist and speaker for the Unitarians against their fundamentalist critics. So, now all of you know that Unitarianism is at least 5 centuries old, and I discern a Unitarian impulse as far back as the Arian heresy of the 3rd century, and some people have even discovered Unitarians among the pre-Socratic philosophers of ancient Greece. But I think that's a stretch. But the reason I'm ignoring all of this history and beginning with Channing is because I only want to consider the ethics of American Unitarians for these reasons. No other country today is capable of doing more harm than America. Americans tend to have an exaggerated notion of their own virtue, and Americans tend to believe that anything that happened outside America isn't important unless Americans were prominently involved in it. And I might add that we've seen enough nasty newspaper headlines in the past month to realize that we probably have an ethical problem in this country, and we should be looking at how we deal with ethics specifically in this country and in this historical tradition. So I'm beginning with William Ellery Channing, and the thing I like the most about Channing is that he was a pacifist, or at least an anti-war activist. The war, of course, is the War of 1812. We're going back a ways. Well, we have a long tradition. And the thing that fascinates me about Channing's anti-war position is his reasons, his how he came to this position. I mean, people can oppose war for many reasons, religious or secular, general or specific, pragmatic or idealistic, political or economic, scholarly or intuitive, etc., etc., etc. But Channing's approach, Channing was opposed to war because of its effect on character. Channing believed that religion, and he was, after all, a minister, he believed that religion was all about character. The purpose of religion is to develop and support character. And wars, unfortunately, have a tendency to corrupt and corrode character. And again, I don't think I have to belabor this point if people read the newspapers. So for Channing, a religious person does not have the option of being a pacifist. It's a requirement, because religion and war are going in the opposite directions. Religion is here to build character. War destroys character, along with lives and property and many other things. The Channing's emphasis on character comes up again in less than a decade when the Unitarian controversy gets underway. And Channing was a principal and defender of Unitarianism from Calvinist attack. Stripped of all of Channing's good rhetoric, his argument can be stated as a syllogism. Thesis, Calvinists, by attacking Unitarians verbally, have demonstrated inferior character. Antithesis, Unitarians, by not attacking Calvinists, have demonstrated superior character. And synthesis, therefore, the Unitarian religion is superior to the Calvinist religion. It's very nice. Gotta love this guy. Of course, I should add, I'm not doing justice to the man at all. And for those who would like to become familiar with him in his own words, we do have one copy of Channing's collected sermons in on the book card. So this is really all the time I'm going to give to Channing. I'm going to move along here. It would be totally disingenuous of me to infer from Channing's position that all Unitarians have been pacifists or even anti-war activists. So not all Unitarians have been pacifists or even even near pacifists. In fact, some of our most famous Unitarians, and I'm including Emerson and Thoreau and the Reverend Theodore Parker and the Reverend Bronson Alcott and the Reverend Moncure Conway and many other ministers and congregants of our denomination, were in fact financial supporters of terrorism. Now, of course, all of you historically alert people know immediately that I'm talking about John Brown, right? You all saw that coming. America's most famous terrorist, and indeed America's most popular terrorist. How popular was John Brown? We all know that the lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic were written by a nice Unitarian lady named Julia Ward Howe. But before Julia did us the service, the troops used to sing different lyrics to the same tune. They used to sing, John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah, his soul is marching on. So this was a pretty popular terrorist we're talking about. In fact, Henry Thoreau, who you all know of, wanted to join John Brown at Harper's Ferry, and unfortunately he was in the process of dying from tuberculosis, and which would kill him in another 3 years, and he wasn't healthy enough to make the trip, which is actually good for us in a way, because if Thoreau had been shot, stabbed, or hung as a terrorist at Harper's Ferry, he probably would not have been inducted into the American literary pantheon, and his inspirational writings would have been lost to us. So it's fortunate that he was too sick to travel. Hanging John Brown after Harper's Ferry made the Civil War inevitable. So we can look at what was the most terrible war in American history from the American point of view, since it's the only war in which America took all the hits. We can consider this John Brown's revenge, in a sense, because the controversy that occurred because of John Brown and immediately after John Brown eventually pushed us into that situation. Most people didn't know that this war was inevitable well into 1860. Then the light dawned, tensions rose, the South blinked, and 5 years of hell ensued to avenge the hanging of the terrorist. The transition from terrorism to war during 1860 make this year the most interesting in American history, at least that's my opinion, and suggest a certain correspondence between these two types of violence, war and terrorism, which is that terrorism is war waged by amateurs, whereas war is terrorism waged by professionals. Reflection on this relationship may suggest the truth of William Faulkner's observation that the past isn't dead. It isn't even really past. Everything that has been is today, and those who fail to understand the past are fated to repeat it. Since the title of this talk is Unitarian Ethics, it seems necessary to understand why all these famous Unitarians were willing to support the terrorist activities of John Brown. My own sense is that their support was based on two considerations. The existence of slavery was an abomination, and 20 years of peaceful protest had failed not only to end slavery, but even to limit its geographic expansion. Incremental progress loses its charm in the face of an implacable enemy who blocks any progress, however small, and even wishes to undo what has already been done. We're fortunate that the abomination of slavery is only a memory, passing by the question of whether certain immigration policies currently being discussed display an intention to create a permanent class of indentured servants in this country. But we're not going to go there. But many other abominations exist in the world today, and I would briefly describe one of them. A few months ago, there were some form letters on the social action table asking the World Bank to forgive the debt of third world countries. The World Bank is one of the international institutions, along with the International Monetary Fund, the GATT, the ITO, various free trade areas and bilateral trade agreements, which constitute the New World Order, or cynics say the New World Disorder. But in any case, this New World Order is a giant vacuum cleaner designed to suck money out of the third world and deposit it in the G8 countries. And because of this money drain, millions of people in the third world die every year. Some starve, some die from diseases caused by malnutrition, some from diseases aggravated by malnutrition, some from diseases which could be prevented by medicines these people cannot afford, or by clean drinking water they don't have, et cetera, et cetera, all the ills of poverty. Most of these millions who die every year are children, but this is not called child abuse. It's not called murder or genocide or ethnic cleansing or a Holocaust. It's called business. Charles Dickens had a good comment about business in A Christmas Carol, at the point where Scrooge has just encountered Marley's ghost. Scrooge tells the ghost, "You were always a good man of business, Jacob. To which the ghost replies, "Business? Mankind was my business." Showing that Dickens knew something about ethics that the Oral Bank still needs to learn. So this is just one of the abominations that typify the New World Disorder. The more we learn about how the world really works, the more we sympathize with those who would like it to stop working. Since I doubt my ability to explain fully the reasons our Unitarian forebears supported the terrorist John Brown, I've made up some handouts in their own words on the subject. The first packet is A Plea for Captain John Brown by Henry David Thoreau, which even people who are fairly familiar with Thoreau's work, I think, are generally unfamiliar with. And the second packet is more of a grab bag. It contains a letter from the Reverend Theodore Parker, who was a friend of John Brown's, who at this time was in Italy when he heard the news. A poem by Reverend Bronson Alcott, a poem by his daughter Louisa May Alcott, who I understand was just a little woman. And thank you. a sermon by the Reverend Moncure Conway, who was a protege of Emerson's, and a poem by Herman Melville entitled The Portent. Portent. That's a synonym for omen. Anyway, in which he describes John Brown's death as a harbinger of the Civil War to come, which to us might seem obvious, but again, at the time, nobody really knew this. At the time, people thought, all right, we hung this guy, that's it, it's over, now everybody can go back to normal. And it was only about 6 months later that people realized that nothing was going back to normal, that this was going to take us into a war, and we were not going to come out for a while. That also was a bit of a segue, because really the rest of this talk is about Herman Melville, who was a Unitarian, you all know that. Our most literary Unitarian. Many people who are not Unitarians think that he wrote the best novel ever written by an American, and which has been made into a movie twice. In fact, the only competition that the novel has for that title is from Huckleberry Finn, and of course Huck has a language problem we're all familiar with. So Moby Dick is probably TGAN. And it's also sort of a Unitarian Bible, because it has a lot of our attitudes and understandings embodied in the novel. My favorite example, very early on in the novel, when Ishmael first meets his Polynesian shipmate, Quigquig. Quigquig is a good pagan, and so he carries around a portable idol, which he then prays to when he needs to get right with the universe. And having on this occasion prayed to this idol, he offers it to Ishmael as a friendly gesture. And Ishmael then also proceeds to pray to this idol, imitating as much as he can Quigquig's attitudes. This is pretty uniquely Unitarian behavior. You know, I can't think of anybody else that would have handled this quite that way. Now, I don't know a lot about Polynesian idols, but our American idols tend to have feet of clay, and unfortunately Melville was not an exception to this. In his old age he became very conservative, and he wrote a really bad story. This is again very subjective on my part, this bad story called Billy Budd, which was made into a bad movie about 10 years ago. And the thing that makes it very bad is that it's meant to be an ethical treatise, a sort of an Aesopian fable, whose working title might have been The Good, the Bad, and the Authoritarian. Billy Budd is good but ignorant, the last hurrah of Rousseau's noble savage. The first mate is totally villainous amalgam of cunning and malice. The captain is a paradigm of rational intelligence attempting to unravel moral ambiguity. Synopsis of the story. The evil first mate frames Billy Budd as a thief. The captain holds a hearing in his cabin. Billy is so outraged by the false charge, he loses his power of speech and can only express himself by punching the first mate, who falls badly, breaks his neck, and dies. The captain now faces an ethical dilemma, how to punish an innocent for an accidental homicide. The captain decides to hang Billy for the good of the service. Billy hangs, fade to black, run credits. That's the story. Now, this is not a story I like at all. I like Rousseau in general, but the equation of ignorance with virtue is just plain wrong. The casting of a naval officer as a moral arbiter is ludicrous to us of the Vietnam generation, or really to anyone who's read a newspaper in the last month. So I wonder why did Melville become so conservative by 1890? Because we're going to see he wasn't earlier on. And I think there's three reasons. We all get a little more conservative as we get older, much as hard as we may fight it. America got a little more conservative every year after 1870 until in 1915. A movie glorifying the Ku Klux Klan was called the greatest movie ever made. You all know the one I'm talking about. It's called Birth of a Nation, in case you didn't get the title. And Melville spent those last 20 years of his life having totally failed to be able to make a living at writing as a U.S. civil servant working in the customs house in New York City, which was a very conservative environment. So I think all these factors help to explain why Melville could turn out something like Billy Budd after having long previously written something like Moby Dick. Because Melville had a much darker view of authority when he wrote Moby Dick in 1851. Captain Ahab is a fundamentalist with an obsession that has separated him from any normal human concerns. So, what is Ahab's problem? This is really what the story is all about. And I think he has a bad case of white male entitlement. Ahab knows that God has given him dominion over the natural order because the Bible tells him so. But has anyone told the natural order? Nature doesn't just ignore Ahab's dominion, it bites his leg off. So no wonder Ahab is obsessed. This is a crime not just against Ahab, but against the God-given order of the universe and against God himself. This whale must be the devil, and it is Ahab's Christian duty to seek it and destroy it. So that's Moby Dick in a nutshell. I've been speaking for, oh my goodness, about 20 minutes now without having made any partisan political remarks. So I would like to correct that omission at this time by pointing out that Captain Ahab and George W. Bush have some features in common. They both act out of a desire for revenge, and they both could have saved themselves and others a lot of grief if they'd known when to cut their losses. I'm going to forego the opportunity to rant about Bush in order to pursue the Herman Melville mystery. The question is, how could Melville draw a bead on Bush a century before Bush was born? Did he use a crystal ball? Did he have a Ouija board? Anyone who has an answer to this question should share it during the talk back. My own very tentative hypothesis is that Melville's genius as a writer was to discern something permanent and rotten in the American character and to forever fix its literary form in the persona of Captain Ahab. I think that genius guarantees that Moby Dick will still be read long after the U.S. has ceased to exist. Even as we read Virgil, Cicero, Seneca, Lucretius, or Marcus Aurelius long after the Roman Empire has been swept into the dustbin of history. I am rapidly running out of time, so let me quickly reprise what I've just done so that we go into the talk back on the same page. The real topic of the talk was the relation of Unitarianism to fundamentalism. This topic was presented as kind of a roast beef sandwich. Channing and Melville were the two slices of bread, and John Brown was the red meat in the middle. Channing and Melville tell us what we want to hear, that Unitarianism and fundamentalism are opposites. Channing tells us that Unitarianism is superior to fundamentalism because Unitarians have better characters than fundamentalists. And again, if you'd like to hear that in the original, much more elegant language, we have one copy of Channing's collected sermons on the library card. First come, first serve. Melville shows us a characterization of fundamentalism as insanity, leading to total disaster from which only the outsider escapes. This we are comfortable with. But the fundamentalist John Brown had the admiration and support of all the prominent Unitarians of his time. How do we explain this anomaly? My tentative hypothesis is that, good liberals that most of us are, we are most comfortable with gradual incremental change. But when gradual change is not possible, fundamental change is inevitable. And who better to instigate such change than an honest fundamentalist? The war is not between Unitarians and fundamentalists. It is between those who are going forward and those who are going backward. Thank you for your attention.